Now is the time, not for dialogue, but for applying maximum level of pressure on North Korea.
The United States and Japan keep all options in dealing with North Korea. It's Tuesday, November 7th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, President Trump heads to South Korea. Condemnation for Australia's detention camp policy. China unveils a new dredging vessel, drinking more water, and safely deconstructing technology. It's all on today's VOA Asia. President Donald Trump is continuing his 12-day Asia trip with a stop in South Korea. At a joint news conference in Tokyo Monday, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said Japan and the United States are 100% together on the threat posed by North Korea and that all options must remain on the table. Mr. Abe spoke through an interpreter.
Now is the time, not for dialogue, but for applying maximum level of pressure on North Korea. We completely agreed that in order to make North Korea change their policy, Japan and U.S. must take leadership in closely collaborating with the international community so that we can enhance the pressure to the maximum level over North Korea through all possible means. I agree with President Trump that we welcome China strengthening her pressure over North Korea. And it is incumbent upon China to play even greater roles to let North Korea relinquish their nuclear and missile development.
Mr. Abe announced a freezing of assets of 35 North Korean groups and individuals. Mr. Trump said America stood with its ally Japan against the North Korean menace.
The regime continued development of its unlawful weapons programs, including its illegal nuclear tests and outrageous launches of ballistic missiles directly over Japanese territory, are a threat to the civilized world and international peace and stability. We will not stand for that. The era of strategic patience is over. Some people said that my rhetoric is very strong. But look what's happened with very weak rhetoric over the last 25 years. Look where we are right now.
Mr. Trump also said the United States is committed to improving its economic ties with Japan and that he wants a free, fair, and reciprocal trading relationship. The president also met with families of relatives who were abducted by North Korean agents, calling the kidnappings a tremendous disgrace. Jeffrey Hunnung is a Japan researcher at the RAND Corporation, and he tells VOA's Victor Beatty Mr. Trump's get-tough rhetoric on North Korea plays well among the Japanese.
Prime Minister Abe, in the weeks prior to their recent election, he was talking very tough on North Korea. In fact, he called the election claiming that North Korea was one of the issues he wanted to get voter readout on. And I think looking at President Trump's visit to Japan right now, Abe is really looking for one primary thing, and that's to get ensure that there's a united front against North Korea, and also privately talk to President Trump and reassure that the U.S. will, in fact, meet its treaty obligations and defend Japan if, in fact, a conflict would break out in the region.
Japan's Foreign Minister Taro Kono and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson discussed that now is the time to apply firm pressure on North Korea. A senior U.S. State Department official traveling with Tillerson said the pressure is having an impact. Is that the view from Japan?
I think that Japan does see some changes happening with recent rounds of sanctions and just international pressure. When I speak to people in Japan, they often cite that you see North Korean workers being pushed out of the Middle East now. You see some ambassadors from countries being expelled. And they look at that and cite that things are, in fact, changing, that things that we haven't seen in the past from North Korea are starting to finally pay off, and that maybe the international isolation is being ratcheted up a little bit.
One analyst is quoted as saying that from the point of view of the Abe administration, the personal chemistry that exists between the two leaders, Mr. Trump, Mr. Abe, is seen as an asset. She goes on to say that she sees it as paying off. The president agreed to meet with the families of Japanese citizens kidnapped by the North Korean regime. That's considered a very important issue from Tokyo's perspective.
The North Korean abductee issue is something that actually Prime Minister Abe really made a name for during the Junichiro Koizumi administration. Abe was an official in that administration. He really pushed that. He has pushed that. He pushed it during his previous stint as prime minister. And so it's not surprising that with North Korean tensions being as they are right now, that he does want to keep the abductee issue front and center. The Japanese government still claims that they are somewhere around 50, maybe 60 unaccounted for Japanese abductees. But North Korea has acknowledged in the past that I think total somewhere around 12 or 13 that they did, in fact, abduct, but those have either died or they've been released. And so there's that gap between North Korea and Japan. And because of that, Japan really wants to resolve that issue once and for all.
Amid rocky relations with China and South Korea, Jeffrey Horneng said it is Japan's hope Mr. Trump will be able to convince other Asian countries to forge a unified front to exert pressure on Pyongyang to end its nuclear and missile threat. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Trump headed to South Korea amid heightened tensions with Pyongyang. Japanese leader echoes Trump on North Korea. All options are on the table. Typhoon Damri kills at least 49 people in Vietnam. Test of Chinese vessel in contested sea adds speed bump to diplomacy. Australia proposes lawmakers prove they're not dual citizens. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, stop by our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Stop number two in Asia on President Trump's tour is South Korea. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Scott Snyder, Senior Fellow for Korea Studies and Director of the Program on U.S.-Korea Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Ira asked Snyder what kind of atmosphere the U.S. president will face in the South Korean capital of Seoul.
Well, there's heightened anxiety over the North Korean nuclear issue and maybe more importantly what President Trump has in mind to do in response to the North Korean nuclear issue. The two governments, I think, are very much on the same page. This center-left president, Moon Jae-in, has been in office now for about 5 months. And he has been very pragmatic in his handling of the U.S. and really has affirmed all aspects of alliance coordination with the United States towards North Korea. But there is a broader, I think, feeling of anxiety. President Trump is not nearly as popular as President Obama was among the South Korean public, and I believe that there will be some demonstrations, but basically the Korean government is trying to keep a tight lid on things and is hoping that everything goes off on script.
The Korean President Moon has he or has he not shifted his stance as far as his relations, number one with the U.S., number two with North Korea, and number three with China, yes or no?
Well, he's shown, since coming into office, a more pragmatic approach than he showed during the campaign. And that means getting along with the United States. At the same time, he's also recently authored a kind of opening for renewal of stable diplomatic relations with China. And that's the tightrope that every South Korean president has to walk.
How does the government, and it will get back to the people of Korea, think about their situation with North Korea and the U.S. involvement with it?
Well, there's, of course, anxiety about the direction that North Korea is going in. However, in South Korea, they've lived with the threat of conflict with North Korea for a very long time. There's really a nuclear threat from North Korea, and in many respects, is duplicative of the conventional threat that South Koreans have already faced. And so there's a lot of anxiety, really, I think, in South Korea, primarily emanating from the fact that North Korea is on the verge of being able to target the United States, and they're not sure how the United States might respond. So President Trump needs to offer assurances to South Koreans at the same time that he shows resolve and restrains his rhetoric, one would hope, towards Kim Jong-un.
Do you think that he will be able to stay within those constrictions as far as his demeanor is concerned?
Well, I think it's clear that nobody can really script this president. Even the National Security Advisor has said as much in pre-trip briefings. But at the same time, the relationship itself is strong in so many dimensions. And so I think that even if the president goes off script, it should be possible for the U.S.-South Korea alliance to continue forward.
What could be viewed as a successful trip to South Korea by President Trump? What needs to happen or should happen?
I think the National Security Establishment, his advisors, have put together for him, I'm sure, a solid briefing and a set of talking points and speeches. And I think that if he says those things, he will do fine. But that also means that he needs to not attack South Korea on trade, where South Korea has already agreed to a revision, a renegotiation of the Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement. And he needs to say things that don't get in the way of the possibility of trying to get back to some kind of more stable environment in managing the North Korea issue.
There have been reports that North Korea is prepping for some kind of another test. Yeah, most of the reports saying some kind of missile test again. How do you think overall the North is going to react to this visit?
It's entirely possible that if North Korea hears something it doesn't like, it might launch some kind of short-term, short-range missile test that would indicate displeasure, but I don't think that we're going to see at this time a demonstration of a longer range capability such as what we have seen over the course of the summer and fall.
Scott Snyder is Senior Fellow for Korea Studies and Director of the Program on U.S.-Korea Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he has a new book coming out. Scott, what is it?
South Korea at the Crossroads, Alliance and Autonomy in an Era of Rising Rivalry.
Scott, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Happening now in Asia, Tibetan spiritual leader the Dalai Lama has met 30 youth leaders from conflict-affected countries across Africa, Asia, and the Middle East in Dharamsala. Participants said they're looking to build both practical skills and personal resilience needed to foster peace in their home countries. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're very glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. The UN Human Rights Office and UN Refugee Agency are both condemning Australia's policy toward some 600 refugees and asylum seekers at a former Australian immigration camp in Papua New Guinea. The UN agencies say the policy is cruel and violates international humanitarian and refugee laws. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where both agencies are based.
The agencies warn a humanitarian emergency is unfolding at the Manus Island camp following Australia's decision to close the facility housing the refugees and asylum seekers and pull out its support staff. Human rights spokesman Rupert Colville says his agency is very concerned about the welfare, safety and well-being of the roughly 600 men who remain in the so-called accommodation centre. He says they are too frightened to leave.
We call on the Australian government, as the party who interned the men in the first place, to immediately provide protection, food, water and other basic services which have been cut off since the authorities shuttered the facility on the 31st of October. Moreover, the men have said they fear they will be subjected to violence at the hands of locals if they leave the compound.
Colville says the men have been victims of violence in the past, so these fears should be respected and addressed. The UN Refugee Agency has staff on the ground and is monitoring the situation. UNHCR spokesman Barbara Balash tells VOA that an alternate site being built to house the refugees and asylum seekers is not ready. He says tensions are growing as protests intensify by local residents opposed to this move.
So we are quite worried. Australia's policy of deterrence by rescuing people at sea, mistreating them, and abandoning them has become a notion of cruelty. So we're trying to urge Australia again and again, take up its obligation and its responsibility.
Buller says the humanitarian emergency should be dealt with in a humane way, based on compassion and international laws. Australia scheduled the Manus facility for closure after the Supreme Court in Papua New Guinea ruled last year that the detention center was unconstitutional because it violated the detainee's right of personal liberty. Australia's strict immigration policy bars asylum seekers who come from the Middle East, Africa, and Asia from reaching the country's shores by boat. Instead, they go to Manus Island or another facility on Papua New Guinea. Rights activists have criticized conditions at the camps. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia. South Korea has imposed unilateral sanctions on 18 North Koreans, barring any financial transactions, as part of international efforts to dry up Pyongyang's illegal cash flows. All 18 individuals on which the South Korean sanctions were imposed were directly affiliated to North Korean banks. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. China's announcement of a supersized reclamation vessel for use in the disputed South China Sea stands to rile much of Asia as well as the U.S. government during a month of meetings among the region's top leaders. Beijing has begun testing Asia's largest deep-water dredging vessel, a 140-meter-long ship that can dredge 6,000 cubic meters of land per hour and up to 35 meters under the seafloor. Alexander Huang, strategic studies professor at Tongkang University in Taiwan, says it could complicate claim disputes in the South China Sea.
From a diplomatic angle, it does not transmit a positive message at this moment. I don't know why they are doing this, because based on the traditional Chinese strategic culture, it does not encourage showing strength during a period of uncertainty. It might mean that China is now much more confident than what they can do, and they will not be bothered by the views of the neighbors or the parties concerned.
The vessel can accelerate the creation of artificial islands, a process that would let it expand control of the South China Sea, where most natural features are too small for development. China claims about 90% of the 3.5 million square kilometer body of water, overlapping the claims of Brunei, Malaysia, the Philippines, and Vietnam. This news alert from VOA Asia. Beijing has launched a Long March 3B rocket to place two Beidou 3 satellites in orbit for the country's nascent global position system. The mission was to have launched in July. A partial failure of the rocket and a failure of the Long March 5 booster forced Beijing to halt orbital flights for almost 3 months. This story and more are on VOA 60. Also visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the suburbs of Washington are the setting for a pilot project to promote healthier eating habits, a partnership between leaders of the Latino community and researchers at George Washington University. The Water Up project encourages the community to drink more water and reduce their consumption of sugary beverages. VOA's Faiza El-Masri reports as Faith Lapidus narrates.
It's lunchtime, and Ciro Castro is busy serving a special meal. A large plate of chicken, beans and rice, a salad, plus a bottle of water.
The plate that costs $10, for them costs only $5.
The special has been advertised in the local paper and on radio and social media, and has brought more traffic to his restaurant. It also helped his customers do what they usually don't, drink water with their meal.
When they over here eating, they ask for a juice or soda or any other stuff. No water. I ask the waitress to offer water first, and then even if they have a beer or any other soda or another drink, they can sometimes give a sorb of water. And
Castro is pleased to be part of the positive change in his customers' eating habits. His Puente de Oro is one of five restaurants that joined the Water Up Project in Langley Park, a Washington suburb with a big Latino population and a lot of fast food outlets.
Drink more water and eat less.
The campaign depends on volunteers like local leader Brenda Barrios, who's been explaining the program to neighbors and restaurant owners.
It's not like convincing, it's more like informing. It's more like, you know why we need to change these menus? Can you please help us? Help to your family, because you know we are, at the end, we are a big family, and Latinos family.
Many customers have become supporters.
I like it. I'm very excited about the Water Up Project because it gets to promote water. What's the simplest, healthiest, and cheapest thing? It's water.
Public health nutrition expert Uri Colon Ramos says ads target Latinos, encouraging them to consume more sugary drinks.
In their home countries, they're very targeted as well. And globalization is very real. They're very used to drinking or seeing the promotion of soft drinks there as well. And so they come here to the United States and they have more access to these drinks.
The soda commercials downplay the serious health risks linked to sugary drinks.
Sugar drinks are the number one risk factor for diabetes that we don't need to have in our diet. Nutrient-poor types of foods that contribute nothing but calories, and those calories come all in the form of sugar.
The four-month-long Water Up Project started a few months ago, and researchers are now evaluating the results and feedback, hoping to make it more impactful and expand it to more neighborhoods. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
A growing amount of the waste in the world is out-of-date electronics, and inside of all of our devices are a lot of valuable metals, also some dangerously toxic ones. All that stuff needs to be handled with care, and Indonesia is working to make sure that it doesn't end up in landfills. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
Sundays in Jakarta mean car-free days in parts of the city, and government workers are using the day to talk about environmental issues. In this case, the growing problem of e-waste and the high levels of toxic mercury, chromium, and other heavy metals in our favorite tech. These bins encourage residents to safely dispose of their old electronics so they won't end up in a landfill and potentially poison groundwater.
Our goal is to reduce electronic waste in people's homes. People usually keep old electric irons, lights, mobile phones, and computers in their house. We want to collect these items from residents and avoid having them pile up at residential areas.
In the first 6 months of the citywide campaign, more than 700 electronic devices have been collected and safely disposed of. Jakarta officials now want to expand the program to include much bigger electronics.
Based on requests from electronic factories and distributors, we go out to their site once a week or once a month to collect electronic waste. We come with special trucks and e-waste manifest documents.
At a special factory, electronic devices are stripped of the valuable copper, aluminum, zinc, and tin components. Environmentalists are buying into the program.
The focus should not be on making electronic producers more responsible for their waste. City authorities should not deal with e-waste directly because they might not be familiar with the best way to dispose of electronic products.
An estimated 40 million tons of e-waste are produced worldwide every year, and only about 12% is recycled. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia, and some of you have been listening on PSU Radio Patani FM 107.25 at Prince of Songkla University in Thailand. We thank you for joining us today, and wherever you happen to be listening, don't forget, if you only catch part of our program or even miss it, you can find us online. We're at iTunes and SoundCloud. You can download our podcast, take it with you. We're also at voanews.com, and you can find many of our programs all archived right there on one page. Don't forget to visit us at VOA Asia Facebook. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Jimmy Cook, managing editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Byrd on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington, and we hope you have a great day ahead.